So this morning, we're taking a break again from our normal extended, taking an extended break actually from our extended series in the book of Acts to do a vision casting series. So making sure that we're all on the same page vision-wise. We know what the mission of the church is, what the strategy of our church is, and what structure we want to put in place going forward so that we're all on the same page. We all have the map out in front of us, so to speak, and we're all looking at the same map going in the same direction, on the same trail, to the same destination. So there are three parts to this Wapato map, to our vision of in the new year. There's the mission, the strategy, and the structure. So if we take a look at that mission, and I already gave it away, if you look at the Bible talks about a missionary God, a God who is on mission, a God who is on mission to restore all things under his heavenly rule, this loving and just rule that he has. We call that, another word for that is the kingdom of God. Really, that's kind of the main deal, unifying thing throughout the whole Bible that ties it all together. God is wanting to restore and repair, especially that relationship between him and humanity, so that they can co-rule this world in the way that he wants them to, as the image bearers that they are. And he has given his church, through Jesus Christ, a mission within that mission, and that is to represent that rule and advance that rule in whatever world that we find ourselves in. So we are to represent and advance God's heavenly rule in our world. It would be good to memorize that. Just a tip, okay? Very helpful to know exactly what we should be about. And there are three aspects to that rule. I'll give you a quiz again, okay? Anybody want to know? Anybody remember the first aspect of the, or element of this rule? Of this mission, I'm sorry. Represent Jesus. Yes, good job. Yes, we are called to represent Jesus individually and corporately. What's the second element? Advance the gospel. Yes, preach the gospel and make sure that it reaches the farthest corners of the earth. And then the last one, make apprentices or disciples. Yes, make apprentices of Jesus, not just obviously of anybody, but of Jesus. That's our mission, if you want to break it up into this threefold structure, I guess you could say. But then we need a strategy also to accomplish that mission. And that's what we'll be talking about today. But we've already talked about that. Our strategy is also threefold. Oh, isn't that nice? Everything is in groups of threes. Our strategy is to pursue. Does anybody remember the first element? Oh, good. We talked about it all Advent and before and after. It was like 6 weeks devoted to God's presence, some aspect of God's presence. We must pursue God's presence. Just like our mission, our strategy has that three parts. And that first part, the first and foremost, is a pursuit and reliance on God's presence as the driver, the source of every transformative and restorative work of mission. Everyone, every single one, start to finish. And the second one, does anybody remember what we talked about last time? You guys are so good. Your brains are working really, really well. Spiritual formation, the second aspect of our strategy, is to pursue, what I mean by that, is a apprenticeship process, an apprenticeship process to Jesus, by which the Spirit of God, who now resides in us, might predictably and reliably reform our malformed hearts and our ruined souls into the perfect image of God that we see reflected in Jesus, our Messiah. So this is what I'm calling spiritual formation. Here we're talking about adopting a new lifestyle, a new way of living, a new yoke, a new rule of life characterized by disciplined practices that over time become habits, which the Spirit uses to transform us so that eventually we learn to think like Jesus, to have the same attitude as Jesus, and to have the same actions as Jesus. But today I'd like to look at the third piece, and maybe you could already see it. It's actually in your bulletins. You can give it away. Maybe you guys are actually looking in your bulletins and you're just like, yeah, I already know this stuff. It's easy. But post-Christian mission. This is what I want to talk about today. We live at a unique time in history, and so it's not enough to simply ask how we might accomplish our mission. We must also ask, what kind of a world do we live in today? And what would it take to represent and advance God's heavenly rule in this kind of a world that we live in? Because it's not the same as living in another era of history or another country even right now. It's different. How we approach mission, especially strategically, is going to be different. Okay, so I'd like to start things off today, and please don't close your ears, because this is actually, I think, very helpful, with a brief history lesson and a bit of cultural analysis. So first, let's frame the issue historically. What do I mean by post-Christian mission? Well, let's look. You can actually divide, and I've done this before, so if you remember it, great. If you don't, here's the first time. You can roughly divide all of Christian history into three ages. The first age would be the pre-Christian age, and that was like the beginning until around circa 300 AD. And then the second age would be called what I'm calling Christendom. It's a thoroughly Christianized age around 300 AD to, I'm just going to say, 1950. And again, these dates are a little bit arbitrary, and we'll talk about that in a second. And then the third age is the post-Christian age, and that's 1950 to the present and onward. Now, keep in mind, like I just said, these dates are subjective. They're debatable. The shift from a pre-Christian to a Christianized culture, or from Christendom to a post-Christian culture, that happened gradually. Some might say over a period of centuries. These dates, those date ranges that I have there, those are simply to give you an idea of the relative length and influence of these different periods within the history of Christianity. You'll notice, if we are here, right, in this post-Christian age, how brief that is. How long have we experienced it compared to these other two ages that have dominated the world, or at least Western society, for long, long periods of time, centuries? We have just, it's like a blip on the radar, the age that we're living in. So let me just give you a quick rundown of what characterizes these three different ages. So the pre-Christian age, it's characterized by a strong sense of spirituality. So before Christianity came along, people of every culture, every worldview, they had this spiritual forces played a large role in their worldview. They believed in multiple gods and spiritual beings who were very much connected to the events of our world. The pre-Christian era was a world of superstitions and taboos, of paganism and barbarism. A culture like this would have easily understood the claims being made about Jesus in the New Testament. Easy. Totally get it. They had only yet to hear Jesus proclaim to make a decision about whether they would follow him or not. Not so today. Very different age than the one that we live in. So for the first 300 years or so, after the resurrection and ascension of Christ, Christians remained a periodically persecuted minority among the Roman Empire. It wasn't until Emperor Constantine famously declared the Edict of Milan in 313 that Christianity was made into a legally recognized religion. So it was legal now. You can't kill Christians. But it wasn't long after that where Christianity became the official religion of the empire. And that leads us into the second thing. But Constantine represented an enormous shift, because Christians began to enjoy privileges and positions which they, up to that point, they would never have dreamed of enjoying. So once the emperor himself became a Christian, supposedly, that's debatable, we don't know, it wasn't long before Christianity became that official state religion of the empire, and the Roman Empire became the Holy Roman Empire. Thus, Christendom, or a Christianized culture, began to be born. And that moves us into the second thing. We still okay? Okay. So far, we're so good. Christendom What do I mean by Christendom? That's the era in which a distinctly Christian culture was able to take root and to flourish and spread to all parts of the civilized world. Christendom is what might be called a creedal culture. The creeds, I believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, that kind of thing. A creedal culture, a culture which replaced the ancient paganism of the pre-Christian culture with a stable, monotheistic view of God. And it based its concept of morality and beauty and justice and meaning and purpose on the Bible. Now, this is not to suggest that other religions didn't exist or that everybody was Christian. That's not what I'm saying, okay? So don't mishear me. I'm not saying that like, oh, Islam didn't exist. Of course it did. There's fights, wars. You've heard of the Crusades and everything like that, right? And not, it wasn't that the whole world was Christian or anything like that. All I'm saying is that Christian influences pervaded every aspect of the culture. It dominated the way that we thought, the way that we acted, what we thought about everything, okay? So it shaped virtually every facet of Western society. The teaching of the Bible influenced everything from justice systems to art to literature to music, all the way to the way that society itself was structured. And though we got to plot the end of this, it ended at some time. I say 1950. That's arbitrary again, okay? But you could say that it actually started ending for centuries. The last few centuries is when Christendom started to end. Regardless of where you plot the point on the end of that Christianized culture, we are now experiencing a dramatic shift in the world that we live in today. We do not live in that world, okay? We find ourselves now in this third category. You are here, post-Christian culture. What many have called the late modern or maybe post-modern world can be described as post-Christian. A post-Christian world is one that is thoroughly secular, devoid of any overt religious influence or acknowledgement of any higher authority. So in fact, a post-Christian culture is one that is highly suspicious of authority, rejects authority. It seeks to throw off what it sees as the restraints of anything that would hinder one's individual freedom of self-expression. Does this sound familiar? The world that we live in? Yes. Okay? It is constantly deconstructing those established institutions like Christianity, established institutions, established paradigms and norms that characterize Christendom. So the thing about living in a post-Christian culture, that it's not as if we just returned to the pre-Christian world. Like, oh yeah, well, Christendom is done, so we just return to an ancient, pagan, you know, superstitious, all the gods are real and they interact with the world. No, that's not what we are living in at all. It's an active rejection, a push back against Christianity and all of Christendom. That is the world that we live in today. It's a totally different era that we live in. So the interesting thing about this, though, is that about this post-Christian culture, is that it defines itself against the previously Christianized culture, but it wants to take the best achievements of that culture and build upon them. Like human rights, for example. Did you know, many of you I'm sure do, human rights is not intuitive to humanity. Human rights actually has its roots in a Christian, Judeo-Christian worldview. The image of God is the only thing, that's the basis for human rights. And now everybody believes it, well, almost everybody believes in human rights. Everybody in the Western societies believes in human rights. And then they want to take that and progress upon that, all the while forgetting that all the good achievements that they love and that they want to take and move forward came from Christendom, virtually every single one. That's a really interesting thing about it. So, summarizing, I will readily admit, you know, my division of Christian history, that's overly simplistic. The dates offered for the advent of the post-Christian world, really, that only represents our experience of the post-Christian culture here in America. But this is where we live. okay? Please don't miss the forest for the trees here, all right? Don't be like, oh, Josh, that's a very Western-centric, American-centric view. Like, yes, of course, that's where we live. That's who we want to reach. Unless we're going overseas, you know, then take another course, okay? But this is what we're talking about, right? So, yes, it is American-centric. This is our story, though. These are the people we want to reach. I'm talking about post-Christian mission. So I'm just trying to describe our world. I'm trying to detail how vastly different these three ways of viewing the world are from one another. So we're living at the beginning of a strange and unfamiliar time, a time that has no historical precedent. I know that there are certain precedents for some things, but the age in which we are living, that we have this turn, this post-Christian turn, it has no, it's unique. So it requires a unique strategy to address it. So I want to take a look at what should be our approach. Think about this. Remember how I summarized post-Christian? I have three things. Cultural analysis here, okay? Let's do a little bit of it. What are the things that basically define post-Christian culture? Well, I would suggest there are three things that essentially define a post-Christian culture. A rejection of authority, all forms of hierarchy, that's out. The patriarchy's out, that kind of thing, you know. You've heard that kind of thing. That's an example of it. Or a deconstruction of Christianity. Not just a, I don't know about Christianity. No, it's Christianity is bad. We need to thoroughly take it apart and reject it systematically. And then the third one is an unrestricted freedom to express yourself in any way you see fit. That's actually how the world around, the culture around us views freedom. There can be no restrictions, no limitations on our self-expression, or else I'm not free. And part of that, there's some truth to that, but not really. They are missing a bigger picture of freedom. But so if we're talking about mission in a post-Christian world, how could we look at by analyzing our world around us, we have to come up with a new apologetics, a new defense, and a new polemics. We actually have to look at these three things and say, how could the gospel of Jesus, which is unchanging, how can that address? If you start saying, hey, guess what? Here's good news, the gospel of the kingdom. Jesus, God has installed his king, Jesus, on his holy hill. Great news, right? He's now your king. Bow the knee. How's that going to go over to anybody? To a culture that rejects all forms of authority. You're not going to get anybody, right? What you have to do is tell them, actually, everybody submits to an authority, right? Everybody. It's just, what authority are you submitting to? There are good authorities and there are bad authorities. Everybody has a mental map. Like getting here this morning, driving here, if I did not have a mental map of, oh, I take 47 and whatever, you know, like I know exactly, I know the mental map so well that I can get here without even realizing I got here. You all drove like that, right? You're like, what? Did I just drive for an hour? An hour? That's how, but do you see these things? If I said, no, I reject all forms of authority. I don't think that speed matters. I don't think that roads matter. I don't think that anything like that. I'm choosing a ridiculous example, but a mental map, you could transform, you could use that idea and put it onto any issue that you can think of. We need some sort of authority that tells us this is how you think through this issue. Nobody is a blank slate. Nobody is free of authority. You just have to choose which authority you're going to submit to. So that's one way to help a person living in a post-Christian culture come to know Jesus. Or a deconstruction of Christianity. If people are already suspicious of Christianity, if they already dislike it, you have to show them the value, like I said before, how everything that they want to do, everything they think is good about society and they want to progress, actually came from Christianity. That's a good way to say, oh, guess what? You're being inconsistent with gentleness, of course, right? You are living within an inconsistent worldview that just folds in on itself. Or unrestricted self-expression. Help them to understand what true freedom is. Anyway, I can go on off this forever, and I've already spent too much time on it. What I'd rather spend the remainder of my time on is this: pulling back and saying, what should be our posture toward a post-Christian society? What is our overall approach? And I see four different ways of responding. And of course, you know the fourth one's going to be the one that I like, right? But we have got to go through the first three because it's all important, okay? There are four different ways, I think, that we could, four different approaches or postures toward a post-Christian turn that we could adopt. And one of them I would argue for. There are true pros and cons to all of them, but let me just outline them here as quickly as I possibly can. Resistance. That's the first one. So let's just be honest. Christians living today in America are facing an onslaught of antipathy, open hostility from the secular culture in which we live. We are painted as the most intolerant, the most backwards. We're painted as bigots. We are called racist, homophobic, transphobic, Islamophobic, any other phobic, simply for daring to hold to convictions that, historically speaking, all Christians throughout history have held unquestioningly until the past few decades, sometimes until the past few years. That's the world we live in, right? Right? Yeah, okay, good. I'm not speaking like, what? I didn't know that I was, Okay, good. Good, I'm glad. Yeah, our firm convictions are constantly misunderstood, constantly mischaracterized, and often thought to be actually harmful to society. And in some very real cases, we're beginning to face persecution, the loss, some sort of loss because of our faith. Of course, none of us are dying. None of us are dying for Jesus. And so we could say, oh, yeah, I'm not dying for Jesus like some people are right now in other places in the world. And thank God for that. But nonetheless, there is real persecution happening. Not as bad as that, but it's still persecution. So for many, this post-Christian turn is a cause for lament. We're lamenting the end of that previous Christian culture, and we look back longingly at the past. For others, this is a cause for fear or even despair. There's no hope. We just get together. I know that this is one that, I'll just be honest, like this is one that I too easily slip into. I get together with my good friend, like, I don't know where you are, TJ or Greg Fordyce or something, and isn't the world awful? I'm not saying that they are this way, but this is my slip in, like, oh man, can you believe these people? They're out of their mind. And that's all the farther that I leave it at. Oh, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. What an awful world. What an awful world. Woe is me. That's not going to help. Okay? but we want to fight back. Many of us want to fight back. We want to resist or at least hold the line. Say, this far shall you go and no farther. You shall not pass. I'm sorry. I've been reading that to my daughters. It is quite natural. It's understandable to want to stand against the disillusion of an objectively better culture than the one that we're sliding into. But this posture of resistance to the onslaught of post-Christian culture and the decay of truth, that's born out of a sense of fear, out of a sense of despair or frustration or anger, none of which are appropriate motivations for the apprentice of Jesus. And what's more, the resistance to this cultural slide usually takes an aggressively political form where we want to elect the right people, get the right policies passed. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but ultimately that's not going to satisfy, is it? It won't be enough to stem the tide of the post-Christian cultural revolution that's underway. And plus, you also have to think of, how do my policies affect the people that I'm trying to reach? Which is another thing that makes politics even more complicated. Now, to be sure, there's some truth in the resistance approach. We are engaged in a battle. We're engaged in a battle to resist. We're called to resist as Christians living in a post-Christian culture. We are to stand firm, but against whom? Against whom? Against another person? Another group? Wanting to strip our culture of the good it previously had? No. Our resistance isn't against flesh and blood, but against the dark and sinister spiritual powers that prey upon and abuse the flesh and blood people we might mistake for our true enemies, the ones we want to reach. We must always remember that our enemies are never another person. So as apprentices of Jesus, resistance should not be our primary posture in a post-Christian world. Plus, and I know I'm harping on this one, okay? I'm going to try to blast through the other ones a little bit faster. Approaching this post-Christian turn with resistance is a natural approach, but it's also a self-centered approach. It's myopically concerned for the fate of the church rather than the fate of the world around us. So it can't be it can't adequately equip the church to engage in its mission in the post-Christian world. So the second one, if it's not resistance, perhaps it is retreat. Not like tuck your tail between your legs retreat, but a strategic retreat, right? Let's regroup. Let's circle the wagons. Let's figure this stuff out. Then maybe we can engage in the culture. Our primary posture, maybe it's to advocate for something like this. This is how many of the great monastic traditions, monks, sisters, nuns, you know, these traditions first began. So they were disgusted and fed up with the corruption, the moral degradation of the dominant culture. Men and women would retreat into small communities in order to more faithfully live out the teachings of Christ by submitting to a disciplined rule of living. And by doing so, they hoped to preserve a faithful remnant of Christianity for generations to come. This is the approach advocated for by books like The Benedict Option, if you've ever read that one. I actually like that book. There's a lot going for this approach. Lot to be said for a strategic retreat from a corrupt and corrupting culture. But there are also some huge drawbacks, right? You see some cons to it, hopefully. Take the Amish, for example. They do this, right? Let's retreat. Let's isolate ourselves. And that's the problem, isn't it? Usually, the Amish probably follow Jesus better than any of us. They do better than me, I'm sure. I could probably pick any Amish person and be like, they're probably more like Jesus than me. And they've succeeded in keeping this their own Christian culture alive despite the changing world around them, almost to the point where they're frozen in time. But the problem with them is what? You could probably tell me, right? No outreach, right? Do you know any, when's the last time you saw an Amish person on the street using a megaphone? They can't even use a megaphone, right? When's the last time you saw somebody preaching the gospel to people and but even if it actually working, that had that weird beard without the mustache, you're like, what are you doing? Just grow the mustache. I don't get it. That's a totally different thing. But you see, there's no outreach. A retreat mindset, when that's our primary posture, our primary approach, we usually ignore evangelism. We ignore the whole mission. All we say is like, for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. The rest of you guys can rot. Right? That's not the attitude they necessarily have, but that's what ends up happening. So what about a third thing? What about relevance? There's even a magazine called Relevant. That sounds so good. I got trapped in this for a long time, the never-ending cycle of trying to stay relevant. I was a youth pastor, so I had to be relevant. I had that pressure. I felt like I had to be relevant all the time, or that, you know, stay cool, get all the right videos, use the right slang. Eventually, you get so old, it's ridiculous when you try to do it. I was just made fun of this morning, right, for wearing my headphones the right way. Apparently, you have to do them, like, behind your body. Like, okay, so that's just my own. See, I'm not cool. It doesn't, okay, I'm saying the negatives. Let's say the positives, okay? This is kind of like what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, when he says that to the Jews, he becomes like a Jew in order to win those who are Jewish. to those pagans who live without the light of the Torah, he becomes like a lawless pagan so that he might win them over. It's about being sensitive to where people are at in their cultural context and adjusting yourself and the presentation of your message to be understandable and relatable to your audience. That sounds good. That sounds really good. The fact is, we're all missionaries as soon as we walk out the door of our apartment, our house, whatever it is. And every missionary must be careful not to colonize the culture that they're trying to reach with a culture foreign to them or some weird Christian subculture. We all hopefully know what that is. Actually, we all hopefully don't, but I think we all do know what a weird Christian subculture is. We sang songs from a weird Christian subculture. But there comes a point when, if relevance is our primary posture in a post-Christian world, then we risk becoming so much like the culture we're trying to relate to that we become colonized by that culture. It's my hunch most American Christians today simply aren't mature enough to navigate the muddy waters of cultural engagement without it affecting how faithfully they walk in the way of Jesus. I won't say that. It's too harsh. Laura and I were having a discussion yesterday, and not too harsh on Laura. It's too harsh on you all. But I said that I wasn't saying it, so yeah, there's a mystery. If you want to talk to me about it, I'll be glad to talk to you about it. But this has a lot of implications in the way that we live our lives. I really am convinced many adults aren't even mature enough to engage the world on their terms, on their turf, and not be colonized by the culture. I tried it. I was colonized by the culture. I got brought in. So there's additional fact to consider, though. No matter what efforts we put into being relevant and relatable to the culture, the gospel message we're entrusted to proclaim is inherently offensive. The gospel, by its very nature, challenges some of our most deeply held and cherished assumptions and convictions, which is, it has the natural effect of making us unrelatable and irrelevant, despite our efforts to the contrary. So announcing the gospel of the kingdom will naturally repulse and confuse some people. It just will. That's just the nature of it. Paul talks about it. It's 1 Corinthians 2. It's a major, for 1 and 2, sorry. So there's this great, I've shared this before, there's this great breakdown section in one of my favorite bands, old bands. They're no good now, but they used to be good. Waterdeep. Their husband and wife is the main part of it. But this song called The Razor Light. Anybody heard that one? No, no one heard that. Of course not. He says, now Jeremiah wasn't cool. They all said Jeremiah was a fool. And Ezekiel wasn't cool. They all said Ezekiel was a fool. And Isaiah wasn't cool. They all said Isaiah was a fool. They sawed him in half, actually. And Jesus wasn't cool. They all said Jesus was a fool. And then he says, this is so cool. And they go, and if Jesus wasn't cool, and if Jesus was a fool, then I don't want to be cool. And then the whole band goes, wham, you know, back into it. And the crowd goes crazy. And you're just like, yeah, I don't want to be cool. I love that thing. But that is so, it's so freeing to say, like, why am I trapped in this endless cycle of trying to be relatable, trying to be cool? I've been colonized by the world. I am caught up in that. It's a hard thing to do. I don't want to go into this any farther because I've gone into it so far. So what is my fourth posture towards a post-Christian turn? What is the fourth approach? I would argue, I'm calling it resilience. It's all ours, okay? And I think that it takes the best parts of resistance, retreat, and relevance, but it doesn't take the bad parts. So this brings us to our last option here. We must develop a posture toward the unbelieving world that is not primarily one of resistance or retreat or relevance, but of resilience in the face of adversity. We must embody a community that faithfully and fully lives out the teachings of Jesus, that faithfully tells the truth no matter what it costs us, and that stands as a refreshing and radical counterculture to the kind of lives and worldview we're trying to engage. So we don't divorce ourselves from the world. We're in the world, but we stand as a witness to another kind of world within the world. An alternate, a counterculture, an alternate social, political, economic order within the one that we already live in, as a light in the darkness. There was someone who said that. Jesus, right? That's what he calls us to be. A posture of resilience, though, requires quite a bit of training and equipping and education and discipline on our part. It requires quite a bit of maturation that's likely seasoned with a fair amount of suffering and loss. And that's where it contrasts with resistance. We're out there. We're in the world. And we take hits. We take blows. We suffer. We are persecuted, and we bear up under it. We don't resist. We say, that is wrong. We resist with our words, but we just say, all right, I'll take it. But I'm here, and I'm going to love you anyway, and I'm going to bear witness to a different way, though you slay me. Doesn't that sound like Jesus? It does to me. It's a hard way, but this is what we got to do. And it's not retreat. Although it does seem like we got to strategically retreat and say, let's figure out, like, what are we spending our time doing here? Do we have a life that's worth inviting people into? Does our apprenticeship to Jesus look like we want to say, hey, look world, do you see what I'm living? You could have this too. Does it? If not, maybe we do need to get our act together, get our own house in order before we can start talking to other people. But you can never forget the mission. It's post-Christian mission. And relevance, yes, we speak the language, we make it understandable, but we do not let them colonize us. This is very, very difficult to do. But remember, we are called, here's a way perhaps to remember it. I like to talk about it. We are to be a faithful presence in this world. Presence of God. Right? We are to embody his life in everything that we think and do and say. That is, and we are to faithfully embody that, come what may. I think that is a posture of resilience is going to go a long way in helping us to actually reach our Christian culture, our post-Christian culture, not Christian culture, sorry. But remember, we're not called to effectiveness. Everybody wants to be effective. Everybody does. Of course, that's why I'm talking about a strategy, right? So we can actually be effective. But we're not called to be effective. We're called to be faithful. That's the only thing. That's a phrase you should remember. We're not called to be effective. We're called to be faithful. I mean, you should write that down. That should be like a motto for your life. And I know that you, I don't know why you're laughing. I must be silly and I don't even know it, okay? But think about this. If we go back here, we're wrapping up. So band, actually, you could come up as I wrap up here, and you can move the stands as you see fit. But if this is our strategy, relying upon the presence of God in our lives, a fresh inbreaking of his presence, and that presence of God through the spiritual disciplines transforming our lives, spiritual formation. And then the third element, learning to actually engage engage a post-Christian culture in a way that they're going to understand, in a way that we actually have something to offer them. I think that's a good start to a strategy. So this actually leads straight into the third one. And this is the one that Greg. the structure, we're going to talk about that next Sunday. And that's my favorite thing to talk about. But there's an order to this. There's an order to the map. We've just rounded one bend, and we're going to take a new trail. So, how you guys doing? All right? Okay. Did I lose anybody? Or? Okay, good. I see actual... What's that? What'd you say?
No way, it was simple.
Oh, okay, good. Oh, now that I should... Never mind. All right. Let me pray, and we're going to sing this song, Christ Be Magnified, again. Remember, resilience, okay? when we sing this, I will not bow to idols. I'll stand strong and worship you. If it puts me in the fire, I'll rejoice because you're there too. Won't be formed by feelings. I'll hold fast to what is true. If the cross brings transformation, I'll be crucified with you.